Our last speaker today is Uncle Dave Lewis. He's a composer, ARSC member, former in-house editor at the All Music Guide. You may have read his article in the current ARSC Journal about the 20th Century Fox label. Forthcoming projects include the liner notes to the new album of music by classical composer Beata Moon, and for a collection of 19th century recordings relating to the Moody and Sankey campaigns soon to come from Archaeophone.
He's presented at past ARSC conferences on topics ranging from Homer Roadiever to Raymond Scott to Ohio punk rock of the 1970s. He's got obviously a wide range of interests, and his topic today relates to one of Rochester's major contributions to the art of recording and repertoire, Howard Hanson on the record.
Can you help me find a file? One moment, please. Okay. Thank you for your patience.
As I always like to do, I prefer to give my acknowledgments at the beginning of the talk because I don't want them to get squeezed out at the end. I would like to thank the following persons for helping me with this presentation: Tom Fine, Carl Miller, Jim Farrington right here, David Peter Coppin, who's out there, and Matthew Colbert of the Sibley Library and of the Eastman School of Music, Susan Washington of the Local History Department of the Public Library of Rochester and Monroe County, David Lennick, and Mike Gray. Howard Hanson, where's that remote thing? Here it is. I'm not sure which way to direct this. There we go. Howard Hanson was a man who wore many hats in a musical career that stretched from the outbreak of the First World War to the advent of the Apple II computer. Here in Rochester, Hanson is a larger-than-life figure, the man recognized as the founder of the Eastman School of Music. To the world at large, he enjoys a status as one of the foremost American symphonists of the 20th century. Hanson might not have placed his activities as a conductor and recording artist very high on his own totem pole in relation to his work as an educator and a composer. Nevertheless, no one has done more than Hanson in promoting the cause of American concert music. His assistant, Ruth Watanabe, after whom the Special Collections Department at the Eastman School is named, estimated that Hanson premiered or commissioned about 2,500 works from about 500 or so composers, almost all of them American. According to my own rough estimate, Hanson also made commercial recordings of about 130 of these works from some 72 composers, including himself, of course. Dr. Hanson's recorded legacy is, to my view, one of the most immediate, endearing, and consequential parts of his overall activity, and provides a unique insight into his role in establishing what George Gershwin called the most wonderful music school in the world. Howard Hanson is the only classical composer I know of to hail from Wahoo, Nebraska, and I seem to be pushing the wrong button or something. Oh, there we go. He entered the Institute of Musical Art in New York, now Juilliard, in 1914, and continued at Northwestern. After receiving his bachelor's degree there in 1916, he accepted a position at the College of the Pacific in Stockton, California. We don't generally think of Hanson as a California composer, but in these years he was one. The very first piece of his that made an impact was something called the California Forest Play, which came to the attention of conductor Alfred Hertz of the San Francisco Symphony, who told Hanson, "Young man, if you don't have to write that other kind of music, you have talent." In 1921, Hanson was awarded a 3-year fellowship to the American Academy at Rome, which he shared with Leo Sowerby. Meanwhile, back in Rochester, George Eastman, head of Eastman Kodak, decided to start a music school, and like any good industrialist, he did so by buying one that was already established and putting his name over the door. However, Eastman didn't know a lot about music and was shortly looking for the right person to run the show. In 1924, Hanson came to Rochester to conduct a concert, and when Eastman saw him, he said, "That's the man I want." When Hanson completed his fellowship, he headed straight to Rochester and took control of the Eastman School. He hardly looked the... And that's it. Oh, I forgot there was a slide of that. He hardly looked the part. Hanson was only 27 years old and had to grow into the genial and wizened figure that's familiar to us from photographs. Hanson got straight to work. His first concert as head of Eastman was also his first program of American music, held on May the 1st, 1925. The success of this early effort, which included a work by an unknown composer named Aaron Copland, led Hanson to hold an annual American concert program on or around May 1st. And in 1931, he expanded this concept into what he called the American Festival, which consisted of 1 to 5 concerts at the beginning of May. Hanson described it as a laboratory for composers, a place where the young composer might come and hear his works performed by a competent orchestra under conditions sufficiently sympathetic to give his compositions a fair test. These concerts were broadcast live on NBC Radio, and when Hanson's commercial recording career began, generally the way it worked was that the sessions were held during the festival, during the day, and the concerts at night, and in some years they would add a second round of recording sessions in the fall just to cover more material. In 1930, Serge Koussevitzky gave the premiere of Hanson's Symphony No. 2, Romantic, which became his greatest hit, popular worldwide, and established Hanson as one of the top American composers. However, Koussevitzky never recorded it, and no non-commercial recordings have surfaced of him doing this work, although there have been some of the Symphony No. 3. The earliest internal Eastman School recordings date from 1933, and I conducted a quick look through the card file of those recordings and was not able to turn up anything that of Hanson's that's that early. So I think it's safe to say that the February 10th, 1934 performance of Hanson's only opera, Merry Mount, at the Metropolitan is the earliest recording known of a Hanson work. This comes to us by a set of air checks kept in what is described as a barrel belonging to the star of the show, baritone Lawrence Tibbett. We have it still because Dr. Edward Elkins transferred the barrel records to a paper tape in the late 1940s. This Naxos release is restricted from sale in the United States for various reasons. Though, as ARSCAD's Canadian members, I'm pleased to be able to present an excerpt from you from this work for you this morning. Despite its merry title, Merrymount is a very grim opera dealing with witch hunting and persecution in Puritan America. The Met production was an elaborate affair, though the show only ran for 8 performances and has not been revived by them since. And let's have track 1, please. Hello.
At night, I hear them talk upon the wind, to clang along to yelp of demon laughter. And now, at the draught, he touched my chamber, and there with flaming iron, and I can serve them, they have me to shine, the devil's fool. I turn for of a sudden it's a dark of flame with execrable shape. Prepare that serious man to bind the hell with fury flame and for his dented breath who cut away the covers, lick my face with hands of fire.
Yeah, Tibbet. The Eastman School maintains a card file, as I mentioned, on its non-commercial recordings dating from 1933 to 1988, and it contains many hundreds of recordings of Hanson concerts, though only some have been transferred to digital. The non-commercial Eastman recordings allow us to hear Hanson in a great many composers that he did not record commercially. This would include a Hanson performance of a 1942 ballet by Alec Wilder called Jukebox, which unfortunately hasn't been transferred digitally yet. And Alec Wilder and one other person, David Diamond, are the other two most famous composers to come from Rochester other than Hanson. Diamond was a student of Hanson's colleague Bernard Rogers, and he is optimistically shown on a 1934 program as a prospective graduate of the Eastman class of 1937. That was not to be, as he dropped out in 1935, went to New York, and later to Paris. What we are going to hear is from a Eastman School air check of a cello concerto David Diamond composed in 1938 and is performed under Hanson as recorded in 1942. And it is entirely possible that the score of this work no longer exists and the Eastman recording is the only surviving trace that we have of it. Next track, please. That is one heck of a good student composition. In 1939, Hansen managed to secure his first commercial recording contract with RCA Victor, for whom he recorded his own second symphony for the first time, the Lament of Beowulf, and works by a number of other American composers, some being very obscure, such as Robert Brain. Ever hear that name? Spencer Norton was an Eastman student who had been taught at the University of Texas. Carl Miller has told me that, "I've worked with Alberto Ginastera, Elliot Carter, and George Crumb, and Spencer Norton, who died in 1978, was every bit as much a musician as any of those guys." This is the first movement of Norton's Dance Suite, and it's the only commercial recording ever made of any work of his, and Hansen included it as the fourth side of the Lament of Beowulf set in 1941. Next track, please. One wishes that in the 1940s, the RCA Victor were making all their classical recordings at the Eastman Theater. Hansen's RCA contract was put on hold with the advent of the AFM recording ban in 1942, and after the war, RCA decided not to renew it. Some of you may be interested to learn that Hansen was an outspoken opponent of the various bans and other caprices carried out by the American Federation of Musicians. But it cost him dearly. In 1944, the AFM placed Hansen on a kind of blacklist that forbade him from participating in the Interlaken Music Camp, a summer retreat for talented young musicians in Michigan, which he'd helped to establish in 1940. Critics and some music historians have tried to brand Dr. Hansen as a musical conservative, but the ultra-conservatives of his day did anything but embrace him. This book, Rhythm, Riots, and Revolutions, is a scurrilous expose of record companies believed to be communist front organizations, and in which Dr. Hansen is mentioned no less than 12 times. It is the only source I know of that places him on the board of Young People's Records, an educational record company established in 1948 that was hounded out of existence by the House of Un-American Activities Committee, though it later reorganized and sold its records through ads in Reader's Digest under a different name. I find the very suggestion of Dr. Hansen being a commie as laughable in the extreme. Hansen didn't land another recording contract until 1950 at Columbia, and at first sight this looked like a good deal. Goddard Lieberson, the head of the classical division, was a former Eastman student, but it proved very short-lived. Hansen made an LP of the Second Symphony and this one of his own piano concerto, combined with the Second Concerto of McDowell. And both of these sold well, but Hansen's recording of the Peter Menon Third Symphony only made about $600 and lost more than half its cost. Columbia decided to cut Hansen and Eastman from the roster, though they apparently neglected to inform him that this was so. In a glass case at the Sibley Library, there is a letter from Gotthard Lieberson that essentially says, "Who, me?" He actually says something along the lines of, "I got the impression that you just sort of walked away." And then he tries to blame the whole embarrassing situation on an underling. One special pressing that Columbia made for Eastman was of Hansen's centennial ode written to celebrate the founding of the University of Rochester in 1950. The Sibley Library has about 12 copies of this record, and they also have 16 turntables, so maybe if we can get together a dozen ARSC members, we can all go listen to it at the same time. Apparently, it was another Eastman graduate, Mitch Miller, who put Hansen in touch with Mercury Records, and therefore with his greatest achievements as a recording artist. Hansen was greatly aided and abetted by the engineer and producing team of Bob Fine and Wilma Cozart Fine. The iconic image of the U-47 microphone, as you see here, is what we most strongly associate with the Mercury Living Presence series of LPs, though in the case of the Eastman Theater and the Eastman Rochester Symphony and Hansen, they were not used so much. A Shep's MK50, placed ever so exactly in the hall, was used for mono recordings through the end of 1955, and when stereo was added, two U-47s were hung alongside the Sheps, though lower, because they were not as sensitive. But it wasn't working, and the team was forced to use other mics for the stereo fills until Bob Fine was able to locate four more MK50s, as these were made by hand and no longer being manufactured. And a full set of six, such as they needed, was not assembled until 1959. The Hansen recordings, and I do have a poor image of Hansen conducting at a session, and the third mic in the middle you can't even see, but that's the only one I could find. The Hansen recordings, and also the first ones of Frederick Fennell with the Eastman Wind Ensemble, were initially issued with this fabulous golden lyre label design. But in 1957, Mercury deleted those and folded all of the recordings into the regular MG 50,000 and SR 90,000 series catalogs. What follows is a mostly subjective series of examples of favorite Hansen Eastman Mercury Living Presence recordings, and I sincerely apologize if your favorite is missing. I do know that his Barber First Symphony and Copland Quiet City are both fabulous recordings, but perhaps you'll like these also. Charles Tomlinson Griffiths was a composer that Hansen championed in particular. He recorded more Griffiths than any other composer besides himself. This comes from Griffiths' tone poem, The Pleasure Dome of Kubla Khan, recorded in 1954 in mono. Next track, please. Thank you. With Charles Ives, many conductors emphasized chaos, but Hanson found order and not a little of Ives' sardonic wit. Although he was working with a score which by current standards is somewhat outdated, Hanson's 1957 recording of Ives' Three Places in New England was the first recording of the work, and many agree that it still may be the best. I need you to skip the next track and go to the one after that, and this example is in stereo. Cultivated long associations with American composers he admired. Dr. Hanson led Colin McPhee's Concerto for Piano and Eight Winds in an Eastman concert back in 1929. But by the mid-50s, McPhee had fallen on hard times and the classical establishment had long written him off. Hanson helped lift McPhee up through the 1958 commission of Tabu Tabu Han, and McPhee turned in a sensational work some 30 years ahead of its time. Next track, please. Your heart out, Philip Glass. That was recorded in stereo in 1956. 56, sorry. Freudian slip. I've been asked to kind of move things forward, so let's... This is my favorite Hanson album, and we'll go ahead and we'll make this the last of the Mercury Living Presence examples. Just listen to the sheer sound of the recording, which we're going to hear a mono sample, done in 1956 also, and also how crisp and sharp the Eastman Rochester Symphony is. This series was the Cadillac of all of the American modern series that existed in the 50s, in my opinion. Next track, please. Thank you. classical recordings of the 1950s are just not supposed to sound that good. Moving along, another important work that Hansen recorded, Hansen recorded at least 21 Eastman School composers and took some heat for doing so many, but adamantly defended it. One of the works he did record that became important and popular and in the underground sense, boy, that's a scary album cover, is the Variations on a Hymn Tune by Justin Morgan by Thomas Canning, who died in 1989. He also did a very uncommercial project, The Composer and His Orchestra, in which he describes some fine details about orchestration to what must have been a very small audience. However, it has done well as a CD set. The LPs went absolutely nowhere. The Middle States Association, which accredited higher institutions of learning, performed an evaluation of the Eastman School in 1959 with glowing recommendations for everyone. However, they noted that there seemed to be a sense of corporate disconnect between the Eastman School and the University of Rochester, and they couldn't figure out just who was responsible for making contact between the two. The Eastman School president complained to the Middle States Association that Hansen was so hands-on with much of the administrative duties at Eastman that he had little actual power over a great range of responsibilities. Hansen had responded to this challenge by hiring him an assistant, and it helped, but it didn't cure the problem. Some positions on the board became vacant in the late 1930s, and they were still vacant in the late 50s. And the president had to issue a mandate just to get the board to meet twice a year. The attitude towards such challenges at Eastman then were met with a sort of, don't worry, we'll get to that mentality. All of that changed on October the 1st, 1960, when Rochester police disclosed that it had arrested two female Eastman students, one a violinist in the orchestra, who had been stockpiling 300 pounds of TNT in one of their apartments. Their plan was to blow up the Eastman School. Hansen was floored when he found out about it. Why would they do this? It was conceived as a protest against a rule restricting female students taking their own apartments in the city of Rochester. Let me summarize a bit. There was a massive influx of male students at the end of the war on the GI Bill. The women's housing was getting shifted around a lot, and the counselor for the women at the school had retired in 1947 and had not been replaced. Naturally, the Rochester bomb plot of 1960 was ridiculous, but it wasn't really Hansen's fault, but it led to some serious soul-searching in Hansen. For 40 years, he had done what George Eastman had told him, you run this school, just do it. But then he ultimately decided that it was neither efficient nor desirable, though those are his words, to have so much of the school's authority invested in one person. After a tour that the Eastman Philharmonia took to Soviet bloc and Middle Eastern countries in 1962, when Hansen got back, he announced his retirement would take effect in 2 years. The final Hansen session for Mercury was in 1965, and that's this album. You can see in his face the strain of reorganizing the whole music school the previous 5 years. However, he greatly enjoyed his retirement, and He was able to return to Interlaken in 1959 after the ban was lifted. And Interlaken to this day uses the big tune from the Second Symphony, the Romantic, as the Interlaken theme. And please, Mr. Engineer, we're all going to get coffee. Thank you for listening to me, but as we leave, let's hear the big tune from the Romantic Symphony of Howard Hanson. Thank you very much.
I'm going to tell him to hold off for a second.
Yeah, sure. Hold off for a second.
I wanted to thank our three panelists for this. So before we hear the big tune, thank them again for a great presentation. We've got a couple of minutes for a couple of questions, if anybody has questions for any of them. I would also like to mention that the display that Dave mentioned, it's in the Sibley Music Library, so if you want to take a short trip up to Sibley and go in, it's on the stairwell in between the third and fourth floors. There's a nice display that my colleague David Peter Compton put together about the Eastman Rochester Symphony Orchestra, and includes that letter from Goddard Lieberson and some of that. So, questions for any of the three? Yes.
What happened to the Eastman Rochester Symphony Orchestra? It's no longer in existence, right?
That's a good question.
David, do you want to answer that one? My colleague David Peter Compton back there, he's going to be talking later this afternoon specifically about the Eastman Audio Archives and things, so he'll have an answer there. Yeah, oh, yes.
Jerry, yes. In your presentation, you had no reference or no images of African-American performers. There was a fraction of a second of a black person on one of your slides, but you did not explain who he was.
Oh, the lady, the African-American lady was an abolitionist named Sojourner Truth. In the list that I've seen in all of these different histories of Rochester, there really weren't that many at all mentioned in all the lists of all the traveling musicians that were coming through here. There was no mention of any African-American performers that I came across. So Phil Charlie?
Philip?
One did through Alan Wheeler, actually Cesaria Jones, Black Pappy, came to Rochester in conjunction with Jules Levy in the 1890s as part of the traveling troupe. She performed as a soprano. There were also three other kind of interesting positions going on. Theodore Thomas's orchestra gave one of the first performances of Nutcracker Suite here in Rochester in 1892 at Convention Hall. Family of William Horatio Clark, including his son, Herbert L. Clark, settled in Rochester. And Clark himself played cornet outside and viola inside the National Theater. And the third one, of course, which is the most infamous, was the organist and inventor Robert Hope Jones, who installed who was working with the inventor of the theater organ, basically, who installed the organ at the Regent Theater here in 1914, was so despondent over his relationship with Rudolph Wurlitzer Company that he went off after he played a recital and committed suicide in a boarding house here. A rather ingenious method, which if anybody wants to know about it, I'll be happy to come.
Any other questions? Yes.
Emerson.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. There's 7-inch Emersons. Right. I've got some if anyone wants to.
I figured you already knew that, but that wasn't mentioned. He was although he made very few, he was the fourth violinist.
Yeah. Steve.
There's a much earlier Hanson record, and it's in the archive because of Hanson's collection. It's from 1926 or so, and it's a school, a premium that was put out by a private record company of a school chorus or a school orchestra, I forget which now, and it was put out by the New York Record Company, which was was basically a vanity press in company in New York City, and was part of a series of records that they did from, at whatever the year was, some kind of an educational conference. And it's the only time I've ever seen an earlier record, and I forget whether it's his own music or not. It's in the archive there somewhere.
Okay, great, thanks.
I'm familiar with that label because they also released some artists from Cincinnati.
Yeah, they
were from
Ohio. Yeah. Great, anything else? All right, well, I want to mention the fact that we're going to take a break now before the next set of sessions. There's going to be some coffee and refreshments in the exhibit hall right next door. Bid high and bid often on the silent auction materials, and we'll see you back in a little bit. Oh, what? Oh, that's right. You want
to? Yeah, just real quick, if you've been to all our conferences, you hear me do this right before the break. If you don't have one of the limited edition Arsk lapel pins to show off to other people so they can ask you about Arsk, see me sometime. They're only $5. And when the supply's gone, well, they're collectible. So anytime during the conference, if you'd like to look at them, I have one on my badge. And feel free to get one, especially new time people. Thank you.
Frequently asked the question, how does a composer write for the symphony orchestra? What is the pitch spectrum available to him, and how does he mix the colors of the orchestral palette? Here is the complete spectrum from the lowest B of the contrabassoon.